The reading this morning from the book of Isaiah, chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. Nevertheless, there'll be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations by way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of the oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this.
One of the things that has always interested me about the Christmas season is that it presents us with sort of a best-case, worst-case scenario when it comes to our cultural art and entertainment. So, on the one hand, a lot of our best art and entertainment is centered around this time of year, from the highbrow stuff, Handel's Messiah and the Nutcracker, to more popular stuff, all the beloved Christmas movies that have been released through the years, It's a Wonderful Life and Elf more recently, personal favorite of mine. All these songs, you know, the songs we just sang, these songs and these movies and these pieces of art that we return to time and time again, and they evoke emotions in us in a special way at Christmas time. So it's best case scenario. On the other hand, I think that we can all agree that Christmas also brings with it this onslaught of really bad art and entertainment, this really cheesy, schmaltzy, sentimental stuff that you wouldn't get away with any other time of year, but because it's Christmas, somehow it gets a pass. So I'm thinking, of a certain type of movie, you know, this like made-for-TV Christmas movie. I grew up on a steady diet of Hallmark Hall of Fame myself, so I know this type well, or certain songs. I found a list this week of the 20 worst Christmas songs ever recorded. I just want to read you the top three. Number three was New Kids on the Block, Funky Funky Xmas. Number two was Cyndi Lauper, Christmas Conga. And number one was David Hasselhoff's rendition of Silent Night. The author of the list said this: if you can't make it 2 minutes in to hear the Hoffs touching birthday wishes to Jesus, you might as well not listen at all. But to me, the worst type of Christmas song, the most grating, the most irritating, is this, what I call this utopian world peace Christmas song. And there are actually enough of these for it to be a whole subgenre, but for one example, in 1992, Amy Grant, which I like Amy Grant, I'm not making fun of Amy Grant, but this is just the song. She recorded this song that will not die for some reason. It's been recorded by Michael Bublé and Clay Aiken and Kelly Clarkson, attractive to ex-American Idols. This song called My Grown-Up Christmas List. And the premise of the song is a grown woman singing to Santa Claus. So let me just read you what she says. She says, Do you remember me? I sat upon your knee. I wrote to you with childhood fantasies. Well, I'm all grown up now. Can you still help somehow? I'm not a child, but my heart still can dream. So here's my lifelong wish, my grown-up Christmas list, not for myself, but for a world in need. And then she goes on to talk about, you know, world peace, essentially. And, you know, she's singing, like I said, she's singing to Santa Claus. And I wish it was just this song, but it's this whole subgenre. There's Stevie Wonder's Someday at Christmas. There's John Lennon's Happy Christmas, War is Over. Once you start listening for these, you'll hear them everywhere. But as I was thinking about it this week, the godfather, rather, of this whole genre, the quintessential utopian carol actually isn't a Christmas song at all. It's Michael Jackson's song, We Are the World. You probably remember this song, the history of it. It's 1985, and all these A-list rock stars came together to record this single, and then they performed at this concert later that year, the original Live Aid concert. And the idea was for the proceeds of the single and the concert to go to Africa, and the chorus of the song goes like this. The verses are even better, but I'll just read you the chorus. It says, "We are the world, we are the children, we are the ones who make a brighter day, so let's start giving. There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's true. We make a better day, just you and me." And by some strange series of events, Bob Dylan, of all people, got tangled up in this project. So he sang on the recording, and he was at the concert, and by all accounts, he almost took the whole thing down in flames. He was terrible on the recording, extremely uncooperative, and the concert, he was even worse. He looked painfully uncomfortable. He walked out early, and later, in a rare interview, somebody asked him about this. They said, "What was that all about?" And he said, "Well, I guess I just don't really believe in that stuff." And the interviewer pressed him and said, "Well, what do you mean you don't believe in that stuff?" And Bob Dylan said this. He said, "People buying a song and the money going to starving people in Africa is, you know, a worthwhile idea. But I wasn't so convinced about the message of the song, to tell you the truth. I don't think people can save themselves, you know?" And that last sentence, "I don't think people can save themselves," that happens to be a great one-sentence summary of what Christmas is all about, which is what's so unfortunate about all these utopian world peace Christmas carols, is because they are seriously trying to get at the true meaning of Christmas, the heart of Christmas. But not only do they miss the true meaning of Christmas, they miss in the worst way, because they end up advancing in saying, "Let's just join together, we can do this, we can make a brighter day." They end up advancing a message that is diametrically opposed to the true meaning of Christmas, because the true meaning of Christmas is that human beings can't save themselves. And Bob Dylan didn't come up with that idea on his own. The passage that Gary just read from Isaiah 9 begins with the word "nevertheless." And when you see that word "nevertheless," you want to look back and see what came before. Nevertheless what? In spite of what? So that's Isaiah 9. If you go back and look at Isaiah 8, what Isaiah is writing about in chapter 8 is the misery that has come to characterize the national life of his people. He's just going on and on about how bad things are socially, politically, spiritually, economically. And the more he writes, the darker and bleaker things look. Let me read you just the last sentences of chapter 8. It says, "They have no light of dawn." He's talking about his own people. "Distressed and hungry, they roam through the land. When they are famished, they will become enraged. Then they will look toward the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness." Those are the last two words of chapter 8, utter darkness. But then chapter 9 begins with one of the most beautiful words in the English language, "nevertheless." They have no light. They look all around, and the more they look, the darker things get. But nevertheless, and then he writes this, what Gary just read, "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned." And the word that I want us to focus on in those few verses is the last word, the word "dawned." So the sermon this morning actually really only has one main idea, which I'm about to share with you, so pay attention. You can zone out after this, but pay attention to this part. When it says a light has dawned, it's significant, because what it doesn't say is, by those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has been developed, or a light has been built, or a light has been manufactured. It doesn't say, by those living in the land of deep darkness, through synergy and cooperation and dialogue, a light has been generated. It doesn't say any of that. It says a light has dawned. It's from beyond us. It breaks in on us. It intervenes. It erupts. It interrupts. It comes from the outside. And the people living in the land of deep darkness could hold hands all day long, and it'll just keep getting darker and darker unless this light dawns from the outside. But most people don't understand that. Bob Dylan is unique in his insight. Most people are in the "we are the world" camp, and they think that this is something we can do on our own. We've got to generate our own life. Do you remember the lines? This is a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. We can make a better world, just you and me. So what I want to do now is we're about a third of the way through the sermon. With a second third of the sermon, I want to look at the top three ways that societies have traditionally tried to generate their own light. Instead of looking for a light from the outside that dawns, there's three ways that societies traditionally try to drum up a light of their own making. And for each of these, what I want to do is use as an illustration a group from first century Palestine, from Jesus' time and place. And the point of that is just to underscore the fact that things haven't really changed much, that the same way that people tried to generate their own light in Jesus' day is the same way we still try to do it today. So the first way that societies have traditionally tried to generate their own light is through religion. And in every culture, there has been a group of people that has thought, if we could just follow God's laws better. By religion, by the way, I'm talking about two things in particular. One, adherence to a codified traditional morality, you know, moral law. And then second, observance of these ritualistic traditions, these services and prayers, etc. And in every society, there's been a group of people that have said, if we could just make our laws as a people conform to God's laws, if we could just become more moral, if we could just observe the traditions of our fathers, say the right prayers, and go to the right services, you know, things would get better. We'd be saved from our societal ills. The group that thought this way in Jesus' day was called the Pharisees. And it's familiar today. You know, you think today about people that think, if we could just make everything that God hates illegal, if we could just get the Ten Commandments back up in the courthouses, if we could just get prayer back in schools, then maybe we'd be saved from this darkness that plagues us as a society. It didn't work then. It didn't work for the Pharisees. And it doesn't work today. It never works. And the reason is traditional religion, instead of saving us or generating light, traditional religion tends to divide us and oppress us. Because the problem when you take God's laws and put them in the hands of human beings is they really overcomplicate things. They make them into a series of hoops you have to jump through. And they become, for those who can actually keep the rules, a source of tremendous pride and self-righteousness on one hand. And then for those who can't keep the rules, a tremendous source of shame and self-loathing. It divides us and it oppresses us instead of saving us or giving us light. It's the first way people have looked to for light. The second place that people have traditionally looked to, societies have tried to generate their own life, is through politics. And this is more popular in New York City today than religion. The group in Jesus' day that looked to politics for the answer was called the Zealots. They didn't get along with the Pharisees. They didn't think religion was the answer. They thought politics was the answer. They were looking for this next charismatic leader that was going to usher in a new regime. And certain people still think this way today. They think, you know, if we could just get the right person in place, the person that was smart enough and compassionate enough and charismatic enough, we have this faith in government and the power of government to transform society. We just need to get the right people in the right posts. So if the problem with religion is that it divides us and oppresses us, what's the problem with politics? The problem with politics is that the political sphere actually has very limited real power. House of Cards, this show, has been great at depicting this. You have power to do little things, but you don't really have power to do big things. And we always hope, but no political leader ever lives up to the hype. So if you were, for instance, to rewind the clock 6 years from today to the December of 2008, what you would have seen was a lot of the country and a vast majority of this city extremely optimistic about the future of our country, because we had just elected one of the most inspiring presidential candidates that anybody had ever seen. And now, 6 years later, whether you voted for him or not, whether you're a liberal or you're a conservative, everybody's disappointed. The president himself, all the members of the administration are bitterly disappointed in how things turned out. And you Republicans say, well, told you so, you know, we voted for the wrong guy. But if it had been your guy, it just would have been, that's not the lesson here, because if it had been your guy, it just would have been a different version of the same story. Politics always lets us down. And I'm not saying that it's not important. It is an important part of our national life, and it is a noble calling. But its ability to generate true light is really overblown. So the third way, first religion, second politics, the third way that societies have traditionally tried to generate their own light is through the arts and sciences, through research, through creativity, through inside and outside the university, through knowledge and insight and beauty. And the group that thought this way in Jesus' day was the Greeks. The Zealots and the Pharisees trusted in politics and religion. The Greeks trusted in the great idea. They were looking for this person who was going to come with new insight, with a new philosophical system that was going to clarify everything once and for all, new truth. What's the problem with trusting in the arts and sciences for light? Problem is, the arts and sciences are extremely adept at describing our problems. For every a personal or societal problem out there, you can find not only a great scientific study, but also first-rate poetry and music and movies plumbing the depth of the problem on an emotional level. They're very good at providing this exceptionally nuanced view of what our problems actually are. But that's something different from providing a solution. The reason that so many of the best movies have unhappy endings is because good artists feel beholden to tell the truth. And the truth is, we can see the darkness. I can tell you exactly how dark it is. I can tell you exactly how far it extends. But I can't show you the way out. So I'm just going to leave you with this darkness as the ending. Because the truth is, we can't change people's hearts. We don't know how to change people's hearts. Religion oppresses us and divides us. Politics lets us down. And the arts and sciences are great at describing and cataloging our darkness, but not at showing us the way out. And in each of these, so what you might say in response to all of that is, you know, well, so what's the problem with trying at least? You know, why be such a naysayer? Why be so pessimistic? You say, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. But we have to try. You know, you make fun of these We Are the World people, but at least they're making an effort. What do you want us to do? Just stop? Just give up altogether? And what's the danger? Surely maybe it doesn't work in the end, but surely there's no harm. Surely there's no downside to trying to generate light in all these different ways. And what I'd say in response to that response is that the danger, the downside of trying to generate your own light is that you can become so consumed in your own light-generating project, so wrapped up in it and focused on it, that you miss the light from the outside when it does dawn. The reason I say that is because that's exactly what happened in first century Palestine 2,000 years ago. So if you just go back through those three groups briefly that we just mentioned and I just introduced you to, the Pharisees missed it because Jesus didn't fit with what they were looking for. At first they thought he might be the one, you know, this great religious scholar. Nobody knew the religious law better than Jesus, by far the finest religious scholar that any of them had ever seen or heard about. So they thought, he's one of us. He's going to help make religion the light for the future. But he wasn't one of them. His views were far too unorthodox, far too subversive, and his interpretation of the moral law was at once both too demanding. Even they, the religious leaders, couldn't live up to his interpretation of the moral law, which is why they hated him. Too demanding on the one hand, and then too permissive on the other. He hung out with prostitutes and criminals and all sorts of other immoral people. And so the Pharisees said, no, that's not it. We're looking for religion as the answer. This guy isn't the answer. Same thing with the Zealots. They were looking for this great political leader, and at first they thought Jesus might be the guy because nobody could draw a crowd like Jesus. Nobody was as charismatic as Jesus, as good as rallying the people. And so they tried multiple times, you see this in the Gospels, to come and make him king. Jesus, lead our revolution. But he rejected them. He rejected political power, and so they rejected Jesus because they knew, they were sure that politics was the answer. So if he wasn't going to do it through politics, they didn't want anything to do with him. The same thing with the Greeks and this trust and wisdom and understanding and philosophy. Jesus impressed everyone as the wisest person they had ever met. The depth of his teaching was matched only by its simplicity. Everybody who met him knew immediately, we've never seen brilliance like this before. And so the Greeks thought maybe he's going to be the one that clarifies everything philosophically, finally. But he disappointed them too, because one minute he'd be talking in a way that everybody could understand, and then the next minute he'd be speaking in riddles and stories. And he'd say things like, well, whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. And he refused to construct a philosophical system. So the Greeks said he's not the answer either. See, the problem with trying to generate your own light is you can become so wrapped up in it that you miss the light that dawns from the outside. Cultured society, all of cultured society in that day missed it, just like cultured society misses it today. And of course, God knew. God knew that's how it was going to happen, which is why God didn't send Jesus to cultured society. It's why Jesus was born in a barn to a peasant woman, and the only people invited to the birth were shepherds. Shepherds, we've talked about this before, were the most despised occupation in that time and place. You couldn't get any lower than a shepherd. The testimony of a shepherd wasn't even admissible in a court of law. And these are the guys that God brings. In other words, nobody could be a worse witness, and these are the guys that God says, you will be my witnesses. And then Jesus grows up in Galilee and Nazareth. There was a saying in that day, Nazareth, can anything good come from there? Despised place to live. He picks for his team, when he's going to start his movement, he picks not the religiously involved, not the philosophically sophisticated, not the politically zealous. He picks this bunch of local fishermen. And this ragtag group of fishermen and shepherds and peasants becomes what has been now, by any standard of measurement, by far the most influential movement the world has ever seen. It's just getting started. That's the way God works. He didn't send Jesus to culture society because he knew they would miss the light from the outside because they were so consumed with trying to generate a light of their own. Now, with a little bit of time that we have left, the final section of the sermon, I want to shift gears and talk about something different. So far, we've been talking about all this on a macro level. We've been talking about it in terms of societies and the salvation of peoples and culture and all of this. But what I want to do now at the end is shift, because everything we've been talking about on a macro level applies on a micro level as well. We can talk about all of this with respect to ourselves as individuals. Because just as societies try to generate a light of their own and so miss the light that dawns from the outside, so too individuals can be so consumed with their own ways of trying to pierce their darkness and their own ways of trying to generate their own light that they miss the light of Christ. But before we get into that, I think it first just makes sense to admit that everybody has darkness in their lives. You know, when you're talking about it on a societal level, nobody's going to deny it. Any serious person can't deny that there's darkness in the world, that the world is a dark place, because it's spilled all over the front page of the newspaper every day. So everybody knows that. But when it comes to you as an individual, you may be more reticent to admit the darkness in your own life because it happens behind closed doors. And other people don't have to see it, and so you can try to hide it from them, and you can even try to hide it from yourself. So let me just say, as a pastor that's talked with a lot of people about very personal issues, everybody has darkness in their lives. There's the darkness looking back in the past of the painful memories of abuse and neglect, of regret, of shame, of bad choices, of things done to you by other people. There's the darkness in the present as you look around of stress and anxiety and depression and loneliness. And looking forward to the future, there's the darkness of fear and uncertainty and doubt about what's going to happen. With respect to that last one, this fear and uncertainty about the future, every single one of us in here is going to have to make major decisions in 2015. I don't know what they'll be, you don't know what they'll be, but they're guaranteed to come. And the question is, on what basis are you going to make those decisions? Where is the light coming from? Is it by your intuition, by a pros and cons list, by the consensus of your peers? Who's guiding you? Who are you following? My grandfather had a story that he liked to tell about a night that he was driving home from work. This was in Northern California, and the terrible fog sometimes in Northern California. So this night, he's driving home from work, and this fog, this thick, low-lying fog, descends on the area such that you can't see more than a few feet in front of you, and he's having a hard time picking out the road. And so he's going to pull over, but then he's able to pick out a pair of taillights out of him. And he says, well, maybe that guy can see the road better than I can, so he decides he's going to fall behind this guy and follow the taillights. So this goes on for a mile or two, and then all of a sudden the guy in front of him stops really abruptly, and my grandfather plows into the back of him. And so he gets out, he's really embarrassed, and he says, sir, why did you stop like that so abruptly? And the guy says, well, sir, this is my driveway. He'd followed this other guy all the way to his house. A lot of people don't know who they're following. They don't know where they're going. And you look at the past, and there's the darkness of regret and shame. And you look at the present, and there's the darkness of stress and anxiety. You look at the future, and there's the darkness of fear and uncertainty. Everybody's got a darkness in their lives. And where is this light going to come from? But cultured people, urbane people, sophisticated people know that the last thing you should do, the last thing you should do, is cry out for help. Because the more educated you are, the more intelligent you are, the more people report to you, the more sophisticated you are, the more sure you are that you have to generate your own light. We are the world. We are the ones that are going to make a brighter day. So the last thing I'm going to do is ask for light from the outside. And society will always do this. Society will always keep on trying to generate their own light instead of accepting the light of God. And many of you will do the same thing in 2015. You'll keep trying to do it yourself, even though it's not working, even though you can't see more than 6 inches in front of your face. Because the solution that God has given you is too foolish. It's too lowly. It's this baby born in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. That's your answer. That's your light, God, really? This is the way I'm going to get out of my problems? Well, I think I'll just stick with what I've always done, because at least if I stick with my own program, at least I can maintain a modicum of self-respect. If I go this way, I'll have to become a fool. And it is foolish. There is a certain foolishness to it, but it's a foolishness that ends up resulting not only in light, but in greatness and glory. So the feed trough where Jesus was born and the garbage dump where he died are now more famous than all of the palaces of all the kings and pharaohs put together. That's where it ends, but you have to go through this humble path first. Philippians 2 talks about this. It says Jesus humbled himself even to the point of death, even death on a cross. And then, because of that, because he humbled himself and took this counterintuitive path, that's why at the name of Jesus someday every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father. You have to take the low path. See, the only people that witness Christmas today are still shepherds. You have to be a shepherd at heart. You have to have this humility of heart. You can't come to God with your hands full of credentials and references and claim checks. You have to come to him saying, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I want your light. Receive me not because of anything I've done to merit it, but because of what Jesus has done. In the words of the old hymn, nothing in my hands I bring, only to the cross I cling. That's this low path that you have to take if you become a Christian, this path of foolishness. And it is foolish. I can't think of anything really more foolish in New York City than traditional Christianity. Anything else is fine. Yoga's cool. Gluten-free is cool. Soul cycle's cool. But traditional Christianity, if you were to really say to your friends, yeah, I'm a Christian. I'm not like a nominal Christian, not like my parents were Christians, but I believe in Jesus Christ for light and salvation. If you really said that, you'd be a joke. But there are worse things than being a joke. I'm reminded of Scrooge at the end of A Christmas Carol. And we'll close with this, kind of bringing it full circle, because A Christmas Carol is, we talked about at the beginning, good Christmas art and bad Christmas art. And A Christmas Carol has been an example of both. The story itself is obviously a masterpiece, but there's been really bad film adaptations through the years, but also some really good ones. And the best one by far is the 1951 British version with Alistair Sim as Scrooge. If you haven't seen it, highly recommend it. And what I like about this version is that it preserves what was there in the original, which is that this story is the story of a man being overtaken by Christ. It's one of the best Christian conversions ever portrayed on film. And when Scrooge has this moment of insight, this moment of finally surrendering, finally stop trusting in his own light-generating powers and accepting the light that dawns from the outside, he has all these amazing classic lines of what that's like for a person to let the light of Christ shine on them. Let me read you a couple of them. He says, I don't know anything, but now I know that I don't know anything. He says, forgive me for not having eyes to see and ears to hear. He says, I don't deserve to be so happy, but I can't help it. He says, I haven't taken leave of my senses. I've come to them. But the best line of the movie and the best line of the book, the last line of both the film and the book, is where Dickens talks about how coming to Christ will always mean becoming a joke to everybody else. And it says this, many laughed to see this alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed the knowledge. Now, Scrooge had the benefit of being visited by three spirits who pummeled him over the head with his insufficiency, who made him face the darkness in his own life. He couldn't ignore it anymore. They were putting it right in front of his face such that he really didn't have any choice but to give in and surrender. And I wish that could happen to everyone in here. I wish you could be visited by three spirits. Instead, all you get is average church service, average sermon. And only God knows whether that will be enough for you or not. But I do think that for some of you, this is your Christmas. This is the Christmas where you finally say, God, I'm tired of trying to generate my own light. I want the light that dawned at Christmas 2,000 years ago to shine on me. I want the light of Christ to shine on me. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for not leaving us in darkness. We thank you for coming. We thank you for shining a light, for giving us a way out of our problems and our pain. God, we know that to the extent we continue to trust in ourselves and to the extent we continue to be convinced that we can do it on our own, we'll miss this light altogether and we won't be able to receive it. So God, I pray this morning for humility. I pray this morning for honesty, for a willingness to face the darkness in our lives and in our society head on, to not try to sugarcoat it or act like it's not there, but to be honest about it and to finally come to you and admit that we need you and we need Christ in our lives to help make us whole and to help show us the way. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.